The 478th formally apologizes to the Concord public, say we in no means meant to challenge or impugn the sovereignty of the Concord public. And the next day, Forrest, they have a mock ceremony where they surrender to the Concord public, and then just everyone gets fucking wasted, right?
Yeah.
History, I'd like to follow me down the rabbit hole. History, I'd like to frankly, I want to know.
Hi, welcome back to HILF. History, I'd like to fuck with Dawn Brody. I'm Dawn Brody. And it's so nice to have you in the den. That's the Deluxe Edition Network. To find your next favorite podcast in the den, click the link in our show notes or go to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. As for today, we're going to Florida, baby. And I know the name of the state can draw a lot of different accurate pictures of the place. Yeah, I mean, it's a big name in American politics, of course, the Mar-a-Lago, and there's Florida Man, you know, the phenomenon of that, like, seemingly disproportionate number of stories of folks there doing crazy shit. There's so many theme parks, Disney World, Miami, and the Everglades full of hillbillies, and astronauts live around Cape Canaveral. And just when you think you covered it all, there's the Florida Keys. Now, the Florida Keys are a series of about 800 little islands that stretch like a scattered toss of pebbles over 100 miles out into the ocean from Miami. And some of the keys are inhabited, some aren't. They're all beautiful and strange, and some have species of plants and animals found nowhere else on Earth. And a highway connects them all. The Overseas Highway, and it's like a magic carpet that unrolls from mainland Florida out into where the blue sky meets the blue water, just connecting the Keys, okay? And at the very end of that highway, the very last island is Key West, and it was there in 1982 that the mayor declared the Keys to be the Conch Republic. Not the U.S., not Florida, not Cuba or the Bahamas, but an independent nation where anyone can get a passport and its borders are a frame of mind. Now, with me today, unfolding the history of the Conch Republic, I am joined by Florida native, comedian, and former marine biologist, Forrest Shaw. He currently performs stand-up around the world and is the co-host of the podcast I Don't Know About That with Jim Jeffries. I saved you, my tie. Let's get started. You have another podcast that you co-host with Dave Williamson called The Merman.
The Merman. Not The Merman, The Merman.
The Merman. It's very plural.
There's an important distinction because The Merman is just a guy that is, you know, his journey in becoming a merman and buying a tail and...
And okay, and you're the merman.
We support him, but that's not our podcast. So
you guys, you don't wear tails. What is the, where does the title then of the merman come from?
We're supposed to buy tails, just so you know.
Okay.
One of our fans has sent us money to buy tails, and we just haven't done it yet. So
get tails.
Yeah,
well. And then have the merman on so he can experience what it's like to be a merman.
Yeah. Well, there was a documentary on Netflix called Merpeople.
I've seen it.
Yeah, okay. Well,
I'm into mermaid. I have a huge mermaid tattoo on my arm, and I did in my middle school angst long desperately to be a mermaid and would have had the internet existed then, I would have been deeply entrenched in these mer people. 100%.
Watching that, I felt akin to them as a comic.
Yeah.
Because, and not to spoil the whole thing, but there's a woman at the beginning in like Arkansas or Oklahoma. She becomes like a main character in this documentary, and she's doing a gig at a kid's party in a backyard, and it's not like a mansion backyard. She's doing it like, you could see the house is a little bit hoardery, and just so you know that she's not getting paid a lot of money. There's no way the people that are paying her at this house are like, yeah, we'll give you $2,000 for this. You know. She must be making max 150 for this or something, you know?
Yeah.
And it's just such a shit gig. And I was just like,
she's like in a tank.
Yeah. I was just looking at like, oh God, this is terrible. So I felt that, but so there's a guy in there, the Mer Taylor, who everyone buys, that he's like the king. He puts the aquarium that guy's tails are crazy expensive, but he has levels where he's like, do you want the silicone ones that are like, or you can just get the fabric one where I think that's what Dave and
like
I are going
to
get.
Like, ones can go in water and some can't go in water. Just, kind
it's,
of deal.
It's not as well. It's not going to last as long. Probably still well made, but it's just not going to last as long. And it's not like as, it's not as realistic.
It's crazy.
So I think that's what we're going
to
get.
And you, does the merman or like the attraction to mermaid culture attach at all to your life as a marine biologist that you,
cause
you,
why did we call the podcast that? Yeah. Then you asked me that? Oh, yeah.
Or does it like, yeah.
Cause we're both from Miami. We're both from Miami and we're both, Dave says watermen, which I don't think is a real word. He always says that we're both watermen.
Watermen? Yeah. Did you do boat stuff? I would feel like you have to be boaters to be a waterman.
We're both boated a lot. You know, he is a big swimmer. He's in the water polo and stuff. And he's always been a diver and a boater. And me too. I was a marine biologist and I worked with mermaids, which, you know, they were supposedly mistaken for mermaids. I don't know if that's true or not.
Uh-huh. The manatees.
A lot of drunk people on boats. A lot of pirates. I've always been on boats and scuba diving and in the water. So we call it the merman just because, we Florida water, all that stuff. Yeah. And we do talk a lot about Miami and Florida in there because we're still connected in there.
Totally.
A certain way. And we did a tour there. We went there last year. We went to Key West and Miami and Fort Lauderdale. Yeah.
Oh, so, cool. Yeah. Cool. I'm very curious about your life as a marine biologist because I've listened to your set, of course, several times. And I know that you generally say that you left marine biology because the world's burning. It was a little too depressing. How accurate is that? Like, what was the impetus for you to leave marine biology?
I have several versions on stage of things I say. Sometimes I just say scientists don't get any respect anymore, which is true.
Which is fair.
The world is burning or dying. Yeah, I have a couple different versions of, but there was an overlap of when I started doing comedy to when I left that job of about 5 years or 6 years, I would say. It was 5 or 6 years. Which is about the time you would need to make it your real, you know, you don't want to leave after 1 year of comedy. You're like, I'm ready. And when I left, I kind of was like, I don't have kids. I'm not married. And I got to a point where I was like, oh, I think I'm getting okay at this comedy thing. Like I'm actually could make not a great living, but I could make a living.
Yeah.
I don't have anybody relying on me except cats. Mm-hmm. And
they won't be mad.
Yeah. And it's not like a huge, I wouldn't be like, all right, I don't have to sit everyone down at a table. This is what I'm doing. So I just did it because I was getting paid a lot of money at that point for my day job because I had kept getting promoted. You know why? Because everyone was going back to school. Everyone's like, we're going to get our master's and our PhD. And I was like, okay. And then I was their manager.
Oh.
But they all had like PhD as a master. I'm like, still got my bachelor's. And and they'd be like, this sucks. And so I was making like really good money, especially for a public, worked for the county. And for a public job, I was making good money. But I said, let's just take this risk and see how it worked out. And, you know, it was a struggle for a little bit. And then I had some, like you said, people that, like Jim, that helped me out. Other comics too, like Nick Griffin was a comic that took me on the road. Bill Burr's helped me out a bunch. And just people that I was fortunate to have kind of like, hey, here's help. Cause you know, in this business, it's like, you only get so far until someone opens a door for you.
Yeah.
Because there's so many funny people. Everyone's like, well, you're really funny. Why don't you, it's like, it's not.
I know.
I live in LA. You know how many funny people are in LA that are still, that are struggling more than I am. It's just like, I can't complain. I've literally been around the world doing comedy. And because of that now, in April, I'm going to Australia by myself. I'm not going with Jim.
Yeah.
But I can do that because I don't have as many fans as Jim does in Australia, but I got enough from going with him and doing the podcast where it's like, all right, yeah, I can put 250 people in a club in Sydney, which is crazy. Huge, to crazy. Even think that I'm 20 years ago, if you told me that, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
I'm not even doing comedy. Totally. I'm going to have fans in Australia. So
fucking A.
This is weird.
What a life.
Yeah. Yeah. So very, very thankful. No, I try not to get too, like, I always am like, man, if I quit right now, I still would be like, I would have had a career that was like, wow, that was really cool. And I'm very grateful for that. So I try not to compare myself to other people, you know?
Yeah. It's
even
hard.
Though you want to be richer, but
I know. Right. But it's well-deserved, man. You're very funny and it's definitely not the end.
Oh, thanks. Yeah. Thanks.
And I'm so glad that you're here. And I met you in the clubs in Flappers.
Flappers.
In Burbank.
Love Flappers.
And it was cool. And then met I don't know about that crew there. and came on the podcast with you guys a few times, and yeah. I'm a fan. I think you guys are great.
Yeah, we love you too. Yeah, you're awesome. Yeah, your dinner party fact came up the other night. Oh, Jim's still the vampire, Frankenstein Dracula. When he literally quoted the other day.
Oh,
because we had.
Oh, cool.
We had Matt Walsh on, the comedic actor, not the conservative.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Good. Right.
Matt Walsh. He's in Veep and Old School, and you know, he's part of the UCB founder, and I had to explain to him on air because I wasn't sure if I had explained to him because we were kind of just texting and about the dinner party fact. I said, "Oh, well, it's about our subject," because we had a famous one where someone did not do it about the subject we're talking about. And he goes, "Yeah, so like one of the ones I remember," and Jim literally quoted.
Aww.
He goes, "Did you know he goes the Frankenstein and Dracula were run the same night, the same party, the idea."
That kid tell you.
Because I remember when he came in, he was like, "That was mind blown."
Yeah. Oh man, my toes are all curled up because it blows my mind too. And I think that's one of the fun things about when you get to be asked on the podcast, because it really is just like, what is the thing that you can just talk about that you love that fills your gills? And then we'll all talk about that. And like, come on.
Yeah. And the live one was great too.
Oh, the Titanic was so fun.
Yeah, that one was really good because you have to pick a topic that the audience, when you're doing it live, and then you have to pick a topic that the audience is going to be like invested in.
Yeah.
You don't want to see people kind of like, what are we talking about? Like,
lost the thread.
Yeah. And so everyone, I feel like, has an opinion or has seen the movie and has some investment in it. So that was really fun and funny. And
it was so fun for me too because you guys were like, you know, we tried to get other historians, like really serious historians, and none of them will do the show. And I'm like, oh, I'm not serious at all. Like, I mean, I'm serious about history, but I will absolutely.
No, Kelly Zabilski, she's not on the podcast anymore, of her own volition.
She was on HILF. Some of my listeners will remember. She was on, we fucked the Clinton Lewinsky sex scandal.
Oh, nice. She would have been great on that, I'm sure. She was on reaching out to that, and she kept telling me, she was like, these people are stuck, have a stick up their ass. Like Titanic. Like, we've done, you know, we had Richard Dawkins on our podcast. Yeah. We had, you know, Aaron Brockovich was on our podcast. We've had like all these people that are like, have a lot more to lose than your, and not like lose, but they're going to lose any of their podcasts.
Historians are weird like that, man. And I'm on the History Channel's History's Greatest Mysteries, right?
Yeah.
Hosted by fucking Lawrence Fishburne. And there are a lot of historians that they have a difficult time with because the whole structure of History's Greatest Mysteries is that they present a mystery, meaning there we don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions. Then they position and posit basically 6 or 7 possibilities, possible answers to this particular mystery. And they either just let them all hang or go, but this one, no, but this one, no, but this one, no. And historians largely will just never explain or are not willing to be on camera describing a theory, a historical theory that has already been proven to be untrue or that doesn't have an answer. So they're like, but could you just explain if it were true, how it would look? Yeah. And then at the end, we'll explain why it didn't. And they're like, I'm really not comfortable. And I think it's because, you know, these folks are tenured and they're published and they feel like if they aren't taken seriously, they, you know, but I shouldn't be taken. I should be taken seriously, but I don't, I'm a comedian. I mean, I sometimes wonder.
Yeah, but we did JFK assassination a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
And we had Mark Zadon, who's an attorney, national security attorney.
Oh, yeah. I know that name.
You might, because he's represented a lot of politicians and historical figures and even in the JFK assassination. And he's clearly one of the most expert. What is that word? He's one of the best experts. There's a word I can't say that I can't remember.
Pentultimate.
Pentultimate. And literally I had somebody write to me, like, there's a lot of things you didn't cover here, like the conspiracy stuff. But he did say that he believes that there was no conspiracy.
Hmm.
This is what he believes, that there was no other,
it was Lee Harvey
that there wasn't a widespread conspiracy. I think maybe he was saying there might have been one other shooter, but with Lee Harvey, but even then it seems like it was, you know, the magic bullet theory he was saying doesn't really, it really, that way the car seats, it lines up and all that stuff.
Brilliant.
And then people, of course, were writing in like, this guy doesn't know shit, you know, like this. Yeah. And so, but he did take a couple steps back. This is why people think this.
Right.
So he did that. He's also a lawyer, not a historian, so maybe I don't know, but he is a historian too. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. People are funny. People are funny about what they kind of stake a claim in and what they don't want to be associated with. And I think people get nervous, especially now with like clips, you know, somebody taking a clip of them saying there were two, and then they are
We've had people that say that we can't, I'm not allowed to, I have to check with my, like we had a guy and he was there for rugby recently and he works for Premier League football team. Soccer, whatever. And he goes, I'm not allowed to say the name of the team. I checked with my, like, they don't want to be associated with our language.
Oh, my word.
Who knows? I don't know. You know.
I think that some people, though, in addition to, like, whatever they may say about, like, language or being taken seriously, I think that there are certain personalities that are uncomfortable being conversational with comedians. Because I think even if they love that comedian and they, you know, Jim Jeffries is much beloved, they just get nervous that they're going to be made fun of. Sure. And I think that if they're, especially if they're sort of an academic person, and you guys really don't. You're not there to ridicule anyone. I mean, it's really kind and supportive and stuff. But
never
I can see
have we made fun of a guest.
No. Never. Yeah. And I can see that people being just nervous that like, I'm going to look like the dummy and I don't want to be made fun of.
You know? Yeah, 100%. Okay. 100%. Yeah, that's, but I'm there to make sure that everything runs. I don't even get to be that funny on that podcast.
You are kind of the nanny.
Yeah, it's like, and then sometimes people will see me open for Jim and they're like, hey, that was like funny.
Yeah, because it's like, when you're on the podcast with you guys, it's very fun. And you're on YouTube, people can watch it too. Yeah. But I'm always like seeing you're smiling and you're having a good time, but you are generally the one who's like, that's enough, wrap it up.
Yeah.
We're keeping us on schedule and you're keeping things from going too far astray. It's a tough job. and to that end, it's time to move on.
Okay.
When I asked you what history subject you wanted to hilf today, I'm curious to know why you chose the Conch Republic.
Well, you know, I grew up in Miami. Mm-hmm. And if you grew up in Miami, you have some connection to the Florida Keys, even if you've only been there once or twice. But I have literally been to the Florida Keys. My mom used to live there until she passed away. So it was like, I would say I've 500 times. I don't know. But I'm in the middle Keys. So you go to the Florida Keys, you enter by car through Key Largo, and to get to Key West is like another 110 miles. So it's the upper near Miami, the middle and the lower Keys where Key West is. And I was in the middle Keys mostly before my mom.
Like around Marathon?
Just north of there, but really pretty close to there.
Yeah.
But I've been in the Key West probably, I don't know, 20, 30 times, like something. So I've been like a lot. I've been on boats all around there. I've been diving. I've counted seagrass and done stuff like that. And around the, for my job. So, this was a story. I don't know did I tell you that I tried to, wanted them to do this on Drunk History?
Yeah. You mentioned it. Yeah.
Because I was writing on the Jim Jeffries show on Comedy Central, one of the executives that was working on our show from Comedy Central also was on Drunk History. And one day I just saw him at the craft service table and I was like, hey, I have like a good Drunk History story. And he was not in a flippant way. He was just like, yeah, I think they probably know all the story. Like at this point they know all the stories, but you go ahead and, you know, send it to me, you know, we'll see. And I sent him just a synopsis of it. And he goes, oh yeah, they never even thought about this one. Like they didn't know this one. So then it was like, oh, I think this is kind of in the pipeline. This might happen. And, you know, whether I was going to be able to be the drunk person telling the story or not, whatever, you know, because you don't have to go as far in depth as you are going. Yeah. I know. But and then I think that was when the show got canceled. Everything got canceled.
I remember.
Our show, everything. So it was kind of just like, all right, well, I guess I'm not doing that. But I just love the story. I think it's great. And it's super Keysy.
Very Keysy.
If you've never been to Florida Keys, it's like, it's kind of akin to like, it's getting built up and there's a lot of people moving with money and doing stuff to get rid of some of that folksy charm. But, it's kind of akin to like New Orleans or something, like where you're there, you're like, is this America still?
It is wildly different. I have only been to the Keys once, but it was an epic road trip that I will never forget. I love road trips, and I lived for a long time in Minneapolis. And so my two best friends and I did a road trip from Minneapolis to Key West.
Wow.
Which means you go over the overseas highway, which if you've never been, this was the draw for us to go on this road trip, because my friend Mo was like, did you know that there is a highway that just goes out into the ocean? And when you get to it, it looks like a magical carpet, like just a ribbon of road that just goes into the blue sky, blue water. And it's like a seussical sort of design. It's like Dr. Yeah. Seuss. It's crazy. And I was like, what? You know, we have to go.
Yeah. Most of the islands in the Keys are very narrow for people that have been there. So, like, even when you're on this highway, you'll sometimes trees and houses and things will appear. But if you just turn off that highway, you'll hit either the bay or the ocean in less than 30 seconds on most of these.
Exactly. And some of the keys don't have exits. Like the earth is mostly just there for like the pylon to hold the bridge up. But it's otherworldly, right? And it's just feels, you do feel like you are in a completely different place. There's that, my favorite was the No Name Key, which has the miniature deer. The key deer. They're basically just dwarf white-tailed deer, but they exist nowhere else on Earth, and they're endangered, and they're everywhere.
They can swim.
You have to try really hard not to hit them with your car because you'll be in huge trouble.
Did you go to the No Name pub?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, it's good food, too.
Oh, my God, it was so good. My friend Mo, we did a lot of drugs, and we were on a particular exciting mushroom trip on No Name Key.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And I remember my friend Mo started to realize how bad her sunburn was.
Yeah, it's not good.
And it was like a slow realization of like how much her ass was hurting on this bar stool. And it was a dream.
I went to a sea camp on Big Pine Key when I was a kid. That's where I learned to scuba dive. My mom worked like four jobs usually.
Yeah.
Three or four jobs. Like, she's just hurt raising me.
Yeah.
But in the summer, she would just like, I'm getting the fuck out of here. I'm going to send my kid to this camp.
Nice.
Like, here's all the money that I saved to send. And I'm gone for like a month.
Nice.
That's what she would do.
So that's good parenting right there. Take a page out of that book.
Yeah. There you go.
The history of the Keys is, of course, separate from the history of the Conch Republic, right? But once you sort of understand how geographically separate the Keys are and how kind of culturally separate the Keys are, the history of the Conch Republic makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, you got to know that there's a...
Right.
Yeah, and there's one way in and one out.
One way out, that's right, unless you have a vote. But I have... I'm going to lay out first the sources for the history that we're about to talk. This was my primary book. It's called Two Mice That Roared, The Conch Republic of the Florida Keys and Anguilla by Wayne Madsen. And it was great. This guy's lived in the Keys for a long time. He considers himself kind of a card-carrying member of the Conch Republic. A lot of first-person stories, exactly. And then because this is a fairly recent history, the Conch Republic was founded in the 1980s. A lot of the individuals who were part of the founding are very available. They are alive. They're on YouTube. They fucking love telling the story, and they love fucking talking about it. So with very little like sleuthing, you can just lay eyes on them and hear it from the horse's mouth, right? So my plan for us on the Hilfing of the Conch Republic is to start with the origin, just where this name and idea came from. And then I'm going to highlight some of the craziest batshit stories from within the empire of the Conch Republic that have happened over the last 42 years. And I'm going to advocate for why I would love very much to be a part of the Conch Republic, and I believe it should exist long into the future. And then at the end, I have some stories of other micronations that intersect.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
And inform the Conch Republic, because there's more sort of similar, you know, areas like this out there in the world. All right, Forsha, are you ready to fuck?
I'm ready.
All right. So I told you I was going to talk about the birth, but first, here is the conception of the Conch Republic. And it starts in 1980, which is, of course, the height of the Cold War. And Jimmy Carter's president. Things generally aren't going great, okay? But in one small area of his presidency, something is going slightly better than it had been in the past, and that's relations with Cuba. It had been 20-something years since the Cuban Missile Crisis. Things have calmed down a little bit. Fidel Castro is still in charge over there, and he's still a communist, and it's not great. But, like, there's a little tourism all of a sudden. We're emigrants are being allowed to go home and visit and then come back. We are trading. We are dignitaries and diplomats are visiting. And this is like huge progress for us, right? And in the course of this, Fidel Castro doesn't love it, but he's allowing it. He's easing up a lot of his like travel and who's allowed to go. But the individuals who are visiting the United States are, of course, seeing Miami in the 80s, man.
Yeah.
And it's fucking great. Yeah. And it's way better than Cuba. And so by and large, people want to go.
By the way, Miami in the 80s.
Come on.
Was like, there's no real rules, I would say.
Yeah.
Because it now you go there and you're like, this is a big city. Not as big as New York or LA or anything, but it's major.
Built up.
In the 80s was a small city. Very like a local city, like it felt like you knew everybody even if you didn't, you know, and also because of, you know, just everything that's going, drugs, that, whatever,
constantly.
Like it was just, it felt like even as a kid you're just like, yeah, just you can do whatever you want. Like we would go to the beach, my mom, my uncle, and our friends, and they would just cordon off an area that have generator, that have like blenders and things going, and just like, yeah, we'd have this huge party on this beach every week, and I'm like, there is no way,
is this okay?
They would allow, like, the stuff we were doing on there, like just open flames and yeah, electrical stuff, that there would be a permit. They'd be like, no, we're absolutely shutting not this down. And it was just, it was like, it just felt like that was the vibe there, you know?
And yeah, it was also comparatively to what they were experiencing in, you know, Cuba was.
Oh, well, Cuba, incredible. Forget it. Exactly. Yeah. That's
exactly. So they start to then allow some immigration, and Fidel Castro was like, okay, fine. You know what? If you guys all think America in the 80s is so great, why don't you go ahead and go? And he like super opens up, like go then.
Yeah.
And to the point where he starts like gathering up quote unquote undesirables and like, you know, some force. And at first it's not great because people are like showing up on the news, like popping bottles, like we got out. And he's kind of embarrassed by that. So the vibe is. Yeah,
didn't he open up the prisons?
Vibe is, this is a volatile dude. The getting to get out is good now. And between April and September of 1980, 125,000 Cubans leave and come to Florida. And it's,
you know,
generally
was in that too?
Who?
Tony Montana.
Me! That's who!
Is it right? Oh my God.
That's how Scarface started.
That's so great. That's called the Muriel boat lift, is generally how it's remembered, because literally like little boats, like people like go get, and somebody would come from Key West in their little boat and pick up their buddy and take them up. So it wasn't just huge boats filled with people, but tons of little boats, and it was visible and it was impactful.
We on our podcast, The Mermen, we have a segment we do called Call a Cuban sometimes.
Oh,
and because we started it off just, it was very organic the way it started, because we couldn't remember these coffee pots, the cafecitos they're called, but we couldn't remember what they're called. So we're like, they call the Cuban, until we found one of our Cuban friends that, you know, that picked up and then told us. And so we have a person that listens, but also I don't think he does comedy anymore. His name's Willie Quetglass, or I can't say his last name, but he's Cuban. And we called him last week just to like kind of make fun of him, because we do that like as a, like as enough, you know, a comic friendly way.
Yeah.
But then we found he was on the boat lift. He was part of, and he was sent us a picture of him, because he was he was 4 years old at the time.
Oh my God.
And the picture, you don't see him. I go, we're like, where are you in the picture? And he goes, oh, I'm in the cabin, because the women and the children were in the cabin, because they kept all the men outside, because there was men that were coming with their families, but there was also
scary dudes.
Yeah, people that they were like, there might be a rapist out there. Yeah. So we're not gonna, and the boat was packed.
Packed. That's crazy. And that is exactly kind of what people were absorbing, which was usually the sentiment from contemporary Americans about all of this immigration, especially when there's a huge boom of immigration, which is like, we simultaneously know that these are like totally normal, easygoing people, women and children, families that are probably going to become great Americans. But we're also seeing a lot of people that scare us.
Yeah.
Either because they are criminals or because there's just too many people look like us, speak a different language. And so, as is somewhat predictable on party lines, when Ronald Reagan is elected at the end of that year. So remember, the boat lift takes place between the spring and the fall of 1980. He's elected in November of 1980. He takes office in January of 1981. And the Reagan administration is like, shut the shit down. This Cuban criminals, a lot of the familiar echoes of like the Republican Party in general, just like too scary, shut it down. So the response is specifically enacted by the Border Patrol, sets up a checkpoint right there in Key West, which again is the last key, meaning if you are using that one road that connects all the keys, that is occasionally two lanes, sometimes four lanes, but always small, and they set up a checkpoint, your final key, that the backups were intolerable, right?
Yeah.
And we're not just talking about immediate traffic jams and just a lockdown of the island, like no one can move around, but they're also checking cars.
If there's an accident and you're going in these, in this road, like I've been there when there's just been an accident, it's hugely, so I can't imagine a road.
I remember when we were driving on that road being like, well, and they said when there's a hurricane or a storm, all the lanes just go one direction.
Yeah.
So everybody can kind of get out. But yeah, it's, you can feel as soon as you're there that, yeah, somebody, a tire falls off the back of a truck and this thing's going to be shut down forever. So it was debilitating. And it was, as I said, offensive because it's where your papers and it's searching cars and it's searching people. And we've already described how there is a mentality there that generally feels like, get the fuck away from me. I'm away from America. I'm out here in the middle of nowhere. So it was a real crunchy time.
Because I thought it was like a drug thing. Because I don't know. That's why I'm glad you've done all the
research. It was drugs. I mean, it was just like, what's going on here, right? It was intended to stop the flow of people, of drugs, and to make a show of sort of a strong militarized deal, right? So the local politicians of Key West are internally feeling and getting pressure from their constituents, of course. What is happening here? This can't be, right? Yeah. And they do a lot of very logical things. They go to Miami, they sue. They try to set up an injunction to block this blockade. They go to Ronald Reagan and say, this isn't very free of you.
The entire economy is tourism.
Tourism.
And so it's this love-hate thing, too, with the locals where they're like, it's a Toron, you know, like the tourist morons. I'm sure other people use it. Toron season where now I think it's all year long, but it was an off season at one point, but it's like love hate thing where the locals are like, well, we need the tourists, but if they cut them off, then there's no money coming.
And even that, like, the tourists would stop coming, but it was also so much of a problem that even it wouldn't matter. You couldn't get around to within your own life and your everyday goings on. You know what I mean? Yeah. And at that point, they're kind of like, maybe the tourists can join with us. That was not fish it out, right? But they had done all of the sort of normal legal channels. And the mayor of Key West, a guy named Dennis Wardlow, has a really noble effort. I would like an injunction to stop this blockade. They're treating us like a de facto foreign country. And he loses that case. And he's standing outside the courthouse in Miami and the press, you know, microphones in his mouth are like, what are you going to do now? This seemed to be your last possible legal way to get rid of these blockades. What are you going to do at this point? And he says, I'm going to go home and declare independence from the United States. If they're going to treat us like a de facto foreign country, then we'll be one. Which is funny. And he was just sort of off the cop's head. And he goes home and then he does exactly that. He has this huge ceremony where he reveals the flag for the Conch Republic, and he raises it over City Hall. And this is where I have a question for you.
Okay.
At this big debut ceremony, the birth of the Conch Republic, what does he reveal to be the Republic's primary weapon, and how does he first wield it? It's multiple choice.
I think I know the answer to this.
Okay.
And I don't know why this is it, but I believe it's like a baguette. Or bread. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
And I think like a sword, right? Or he, like, didn't he have it like in a, I know at one point they were like shooting them out of fake cannons or something. Oh my God,
you're exactly right.
But I always was like, why is it a baguette?
The baguette wouldn't make any sense because baguette is French, of course, but it is a loaf of stale Cuban bread.
Okay. Yeah. But which is a similar shape.
It's a similar shape.
I think it's better. I grew up eating it. So it's like a butter, it's a buttery grape bread.
It's really good.
That makes more sense, the Cuban bread.
So he has this huge ceremony, right? And sitting in the front row is this U.S. Navy officer, because it's a lot of, you know, military establishments kind of out there. And he's watching this flag and seeing this kind of declaration. It's all very strange. And Dennis Wardlow takes this Cuban steel bit and hits him over the head with it, breaking it in half.
That would hurt, actually. Stale bread. I mean, it's not going to kill you, but
he declares war on the United States with this gesture. And then in less than a minute, he surrenders to the United States and requests $1 billion in aid.
Yeah. Which is brilliant.
It's just brilliant.
So, I mean, I'm obviously thought that out. How smart is that?
It's so smart. And then he reveals the motto for their new republic, which is, we seceded where others failed.
Yeah.
It really brings me to the beating heart of, like, why I love the Conch Republic. Because it is funny. It is tongue in cheek, but it's also really effective because as hilarious as that image is, those checkpoints are gone within 2 months and with like very little fanfare that nobody makes a big deal about the fact that they're gone.
I mean, imagine
they're
now.
Just gone.
Like imagine the whole scene.
Right.
With Instagram and TikTok and Twitter. And it's like, it would be massive. Like it would be this huge story and people would, it would galvanize like the whole country behind them. Yeah. It was like,
totally. Yeah. And this is where I think like, when you consider like the role of like the jester in the, to the king, you know, this very unique position, which can, is one of the few that can speak criticism to power because they're able to encompass it in levity, you know, and how powerful that is.
And the Key West, by the way, in the Keys, really Key West too, is the whole place is just like this, like unreal place. And that's kind of like, everything feels like it's not like almost like a joke.
It's whimsical.
Yeah, whimsical.
Yeah, it's a sort of like a mutually agreed upon fantasy. It's got like a little bit of Renfest.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. Yeah. With like a little. It's
bizarre. Sunset. At sunset at the there's a what is it Mallory Square or is it Mallory Square or I can't remember the name. But there's like a pier there, and you go there and there's all these buskers at sunset. And like one of the ones I used to love when I was young, I don't know if he's still there. This guy just had like 10 cats that he trained.
Yeah.
And they would jump through like fire hoops and shit that now he'd be on TV, like on America's Got Talent. And I would just be like, this guy's got trained cats on a pier at sunset. And
then
And then next to him, there's just a guy in it, like squeezing himself into a plastic box, some contortionist. You're like,
this is awesome.
This is cool. We're going to have. And also, when you land, by the way, here's another thing. When you land at the airport, it's a very, very small terminal.
Yeah.
I think it's only like Delta and Southwest flying there, maybe one of their airline. And where the baggage claim area is really small, and there's a tiki bar in there. But like
that is perfect.
At baggage claim, so it's awesome.
The Conch Republic flag, the motto, the whole thing really fit perfectly over that culture that was like already there. And they have their annual independence celebration, which is like drag races and bed races down Duval Street, and it's just kind of debauchery.
Yeah.
But it isn't always fun and games.
This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
What do you get when you take two childhood friends with a passion for unexplored history and a whole lot of booze?
You get the goofiest game in history, Queen's Podcast.
Hi, I'm Nathan.
And I'm Katie, and we're the hosts of Queen's Podcast.
Join us while we spill the tea on women from history.
We get into all kinds of stories here, like biographies of lesser known figures, for instance, Sayida Halhura, powerful pirate queen.
To the stories you might already know, like Marie Antoinette or Cleopatra, but with a fun twist.
Each queen is paired with a cocktail that'll totally get you in the mood to hear fun, juicy, and dramatic stories from history.
Because history is so much more than just dudes on a battlefield, and we believe that the female perspective and roles are just as deserving of their time in the spotlight.
Right. So come get to know these queens. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Cheers.
Before we return to our cheeseburger in paradise, a little love for my favorite dish, Hilth patrons. The newest to jump into bed with us are Callie with a K, Andrew M, Rachel V, and Miss Lady Squishy Buns. Join me in gently caressing the inner thigh of these generous lovers of history. They help me pay for the books and subscriptions that are my research, and I, in turn, slip them a little something, including early access to new episodes and bonus content each week in between. Check out What's What at patreon.com/HILFpodcast. Then head over to Instagram and
follow me, follow me, follow me, follow. Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow. Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow. Follow me, follow me, follow me, follow.
This next story I want to tell you is my favorite story from within the annals of the Conch Republic. It takes place about 12 years after that 1982 Cuban bread-breaking inception of the Republic. It's September 20th, 1995, and the U.S. Army Reserve's 478th Civil Affairs Battalion decides to conduct a training operation as if they are invading a foreign island. And where better to practice invading a foreign island than Key West?
Yeah.
It's going to be a huge exercise involving a huge portion of the Navy, and nobody told Key West about it. It's sort of secret, but not top secret or anything.
There's a base there.
These things are kind of understood, but they're also not going to necessarily tip their hand. Well, the news breaks. It gets rumored that this thing is about to happen. And the Secretary General of the Conch Republic, a guy named Sir Peter Anderson, you're going to hear more about him a little bit later, hears the news while he's cleaning a bilge, his bilge cleaning business, okay? And he's like, oh, shit. We're about to be invaded. And so he drops everything and he goes to gather the Conch Republic Navy to react to this invasion. And the Conch Republic Navy consists at that time of a commandeered tall ship, which for those of you who can't imagine is like a pirate ship. It's like a big old fashioned sailboat with like the
tall
mast.
They probably give tours to tourists on it normally.
Exactly. And it's called the Western Union. And they put on whatever uniforms they made up and they sail out into the harbor to meet the Coast Guard's cutter that is coming in hot. And for those of you who aren't boat people, a modern cutter is a very fast, scary, modern looking boat.
It's got a lot of guns. It's Coast Guard, people think they know.
So they got a sharp ass front that cuts through the waves. It's very spooky. Coming up against this like yo-ho-ho kind of ship. And they meet each other out there in the bay. Now you already got, your first question was like flawless. You didn't even need the multiple choice. So here's another question for this story. When the Western Union tall ship meets the Coast Guard cutter named Diligence out there in the middle of the harbor, there is an actual sea battle that takes place. Your question is, who fired first? The Conch Republic or the U.S. Coast Guard?
I don't know. I don't know the answer. I'm going to say the Conch Republic because I don't feel like the Coast Guard would fire first. It seems like that would be terrible.
The Conch Republic fired first. So the second part of that question is, what did they fire?
Okay, this is where I remember the bread thing.
Yeah.
But I remember reading about this and I was like, what's with the bread? Cuban bread makes sense, which by the way, how much do they just have?
They do.
Like apparently. Cuban bread, like sitting there, like just in a basket. Like, hey, this is our ammo. We got to keep it.
Apparently what they said is like Cuban bread, as you said, is like really good and buttery, but it goes stale fast.
Yeah.
So the idea is that they always have stale bread because it goes stale so fast. But that's not all they throw. There's two other things.
Did they throw it or I felt like they were launching it out of something like a potato cannon or something.
They also dropped it from the air. They also flew over with some seaplanes and dropped it from the air.
That's so funny.
Water balloons and conch fritters.
Oh, I can't waste a conch fritter. They're so good.
But get this, the Coast Guard does fire back with fire hoses.
Oh, okay.
Which I think
still
is
not
kind
good,
of,
but
still
like,
not great.
But like, I thought it was gonna be actual ammunition. I was like,
but then get this.
But they had to be like, if I was on that boat, I'd be laughing.
And they said to him, they were like, what are you doing? Why are you out here? And they were like, you are violating our sovereignty. And they were like, we're sorry. So get this. Once they kind of realize what's going on, the 478th formally apologizes to the Conch Republic, say we in no means meant to challenge or impugn the sovereignty of the Conch Republic. And the next day, Forrest, they have a mock ceremony where they surrender to the Conch Republic and then just everyone gets fucking wasted, right?
Yeah.
But as hilarious as this is, again, it kills me. The fucking fritters dropped from an airplane and this mock surrender. But guess what? There was no invasion.
Yeah.
Like a pretend or otherwise. And I start to be like, I think, fuck, this is the way, man.
Because it's a combination of them being serious and goofy. Yeah. You know, where they're like, no, we're serious about this, but also we're dropping water balloons on you.
We're, yeah.
Like,
and
so,
we also
so they say, when they're dropping the water balloons, they can't be like, all right, let's drop. They got to be like, ha, 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 like, drop it.
Yeah.
And they're dropping conch fritters.
Conch fritters. And also for the Navy, the Coast Guard to be like, yeah, we can't. Like, we, yeah. And in addition, they also fucked it up because they had come on land in a couple of places and some Conch Republic representatives had also blocked roads.
Yeah.
And were like, no. And they laughed. And it was the same thing. But also this exercise is over.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, like we're not going to
shut it down.
So do it. Yeah.
Amazing.
Is an impressive number of literary figures, for as tiny as Key West is, of famous literary figures who either lived in Key West or like made their biggest work, yeah. You know, in Key West. It has a real like art draw for artists and rogues, and specifically not just like writers, but like drunk, traumatized writers,
yeah.
For the most part. An incomplete list includes Ernest Hemingway, famously lived there from the 1920s, 40s. He had those six-fingered cats, those polydactyl cats, look like they're wearing mittens. They walk all over the island.
I did a tour, and so I had already been to it, but I had not been to it in years. Yeah. And since we had Louise, we kind of was doing touristy,
yeah.
Whatever. And so we promoted our show to everybody there, and we did the little tour around ever, and there's still cats everywhere. Like
everywhere. Yeah, and they can pick shit up with that weird thumb. Yeah, yeah, it's very cool.
The swimming pool that was there, did you know about that?
No.
That, was like, whichever wife he was married to that was living there, he had pissed her off for whatever. I left again. I think he had a mistress in Spain or whatever Ernest Hemingway was
there. Sure, yeah.
And so she decided to take... to get a swimming pool built in Key West, which right now, if you did that, would be super expensive and hard because you go down 1 foot or 2 feet and it's water, you know, but it's all rock. It's all rock. But back then it would be super expensive. And so she built this giant swimming pool. It's still there. And then where his boxing ring or something was there. And he came back and he's like, what the fuck is this? She goes, yeah, I built a swimming pool. And also it costs you like 25. It costs like $400,000 in today's money or something crazy
that. Yeah.
And
also, you do not need a swimming pool in Key West. You can
no.
The water is
It's really, anyways. It's a really cool thing. But when you go there, and I don't want to infringe on your other episode, but when you go there, they don't let you in this part. You can just stand behind this like kind of grating and look in. There's a separate guest house kind of thing.
Yeah.
And on the top part of that is where he wrote
almost all
five or six of his novels.
Yeah.
And so you can see the whole thing, and it's pretty cool.
It's very cool.
So hot though. Like when I was there, we were there in September and it's really hot. And so this is as hot as it would be when he's writing there. I'm like, who the fuck's writing novels in this? Like, kind of like this. But it's really cool.
It's really cool. It's so, and you can feel it too. And it was Tennessee Williams was there from the 1940s to the 1980s.
Yeah.
Jimmy Buffett, of course. Pretty much no one disregards that Margaritaville is Key West.
Yeah.
Hunter S. Thompson was there 70s, 80s, and 90s. The Rum Diaries is set in Puerto Rico, but you can kind of feel real Key West feeling there. I was actually reading Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas when I went because we were doing so many drugs that I was like, felt tame. I felt like a real teetotaler.
I didn't know he had a connection to Key West, but that makes sense.
And Robert Frost lived there for 16 consecutive winters. And he's one of my favorite. He wrote my favorite poem of all time, The Roadless. The Road Not Taken.
You know what? I just remembered something at the Ernest Hemingway house, too, that really pissed me off. Hmm. We're going through this. Oh God. There was a woman there that had a dog that she said was a service dog, but it wasn't acting like a service dog. You know what I'm saying? It was a little bit. And this is my opinion. There was two people with service dogs there. I'm like, I know that they're supposed to be allowed everywhere there is, but if you go to a place where there's literally, I don't know how many cats live on this property, but I'd say 100 or something.
Yeah.
And they were kind of bothering the cats at certain points. And she was like kind of letting them, you know, and I was like, nah, not allowed. And she was really, cause she was annoying too, the whole tour. She was just annoying.
Yeah.
And then at the very end they go, this fountain right here was the urinal at Sloppy Joe's and Ernest Hemingway took it here. And then he, you know, cleaned it out. And now this is a fountain that the cats drink out of. And then she let her dog drink out of it. And so anyways, to that lady, if you're listening, fuck you.
You fucking suck. Yeah. See, now you can understand why Key West gets like, get these fucking tourists out of here, right? Assholes ruin it.
Fuck that lady.
There was an almost dark chapter in the history of the Conch Republic. And it comes down to their novelty passports. So they have a lot of cool merch, right? And their passports look and feel very much like every other real passport. It's got that like thick paper. And apparently it does actually function as an ID for several areas within the Keys, which I find hilarious.
The Keys, okay.
Within the Keys, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Anyone buy one?
Anyone can buy one. And you can order one now and they'll mail it to you. I've never seen them. It's a souvenir.
I've never seen them because I guess I'm not like looking for souvenirs when I'm there, but yeah.
Good news, stocking stuffer is coming your way. Okay. And on 9/11, apparently, there started this rumor that within the rubble of the Twin Towers was found a fake passport by one of the hijackers named Mohammed Atta. Mm-hmm. Quickly, people are like, a fake passport, a novelty passport. It must have been one of those Conch Republic passports.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the FBI descends upon the headquarters of the Conch Republic to like, what the hot fuck,
This man. Is still funny, by the way.
It is still very funny.
this doesn't even seem dark to me. Maybe because I'm a comedian.
It's ridiculous. So they come down to the Conch, and the Conch Republic, even though these are exclusively like rum-soaked, sunburned bums, are also excellent record keepers, and they are very serious about the Conch Republic, and they're like, no problem, man. Two things you should know. We have 25,000 applications, all in these banker boxes, well organized. Here you go. Have at it. Look through all of our documents. And
when you get one of these passports, you have to apply?
Yeah. You got to fill out your application because mostly because they have to enter all your details into it, right? So they're like, here's all. And also, heads up, guys, we told you in 2000, last year, that we were getting a suspicious number of passport applications from Middle Eastern countries, although it was like mostly Pakistan.
Yeah.
They were like, we told you that there were all these weird people applying for our passports and that even though they're not legal and we don't pretend they're legal, that somebody might have a nefarious feeling. And the FBI was like, oh, wait, what? And like looked through their documents and I'm like, oh, yeah, you guys did kind of tell us about that. And
so them and the CIA.
Man, this is what's nuts. And I want to say, too, that most of this information comes from this book. I have not found, outside of this book, a lot of corroboration for this story.
Okay.
So take the grain of salt with that. But the dude who originally said, I found this fake passport for Mohammed Atta in the rubble, was the New York City police commissioner at the time, Bernard Carrick. So they come back to him and they're like, where is this passport? Like, what is the passport you found? And he goes, oh, no, I didn't find it. Somebody gave it to me. Somebody else found it and gave it to me. And then they were like, who was that? And the story then starts to get really like, oh, I don't know, it's very weird and suspicious, which would be the end of the story, except that this particular New York City police commissioner, Bernard Carrick, spent time in federal prison after this for tax fraud, for ethics violations, for conspiracy, for corruption. He was pardoned by Donald Trump and was at the Capitol on January 6th.
Oh, yeah.
And I only tell you this because what this means is that we have drawn a line, strung threads from 9/11 straight through the Conch Republic right down there to January 6th. These are the kind of crazy rabbit holes we get to go down.
I was just picturing Mohammed Atta's, like, his Conch Republic passport would be just like with a drink with an umbrella in it, like,
right?
Death to America.
Who could, like, if you want to kill America, we get it, but like not the Conch Republic. Like, nobody gets that.
Yeah. That would have turned him. He would have been like, you know what, guys?
This place is all right.
I've been to Sloppy Joe's. I went to the aquarium. Oh, we're good.
Yeah, flip flops really make you feel better about everything.
Have you had a conch fritter?
If not,
they're amazing.
They shoot them right at you. This was another great story. This was called the Great Buoy Attack of 2022. This is recent history.
Buoy attack.
The big ass buoy. So there is this big ass buoy out at the end of Key West that is kind of it's a tourist stop if you can get out there. And it has a sign on it that basically says, this is the end of the United States and Cuba.
Oh, the Southernmost Point.
Yeah.
Oh, that buoy. Yeah, that buoy. Yeah.
And Cuba's 90 miles that way. Yeah. Good luck out there, right? And on New Year's Eve, 2022, these two drunk guys go out there. They put a Christmas tree on it and they lit it on fire, causing give or take $5,000 worth of damage.
Yeah, it's like the Las Vegas sign.
100%.
Yeah, yeah.
100%. Very draw for drunks, right?
We went there because we're with Louise. I'm like, you got to get a picture here. It was fun doing all this stuff again. I was like, and it's like just in this neighborhood, it's just like a little phone.
Yeah.
There's an old phone bank because it was a cable running to Cuba from there.
But it's also adorable. And it's special too.
When there's a hurricane and it's hitting Key West, the reporters are always there. We're here by the southernmost point to win.
As you can see. You can imagine if somebody lights it on fire and ruins it, sucks. Everyone gets mad, right? Yeah. So they have pictures of like kind of grainy pictures of these two people surveilled. And a bartender from Irish Kevin's Pub on Duval Street is like, I know who they are and I can identify.
Yeah.
And it's Cameron Brody. I feel like we should out him. It's one Texas resident and one Florida resident. And the bartender who spotted him is named Cameron Brody. And he's like, I know it was them. And they get arrested and they come to the bartender. They're like, how do you know that the two that you see here are the ones that were out on the buoy? And he said, I know it was a busy night. It was New Year's Eve, right? So the bar was packed.
Yeah.
But I know these two guys because they were the only ones who didn't tip me.
Ah, there you go. Tip your bartenders.
So I told you earlier about Sir Peter Anderson. He's the bilge cleaner who decided to rally the Conch Republic Navy to meet the Coast Guard. He's just like, he passed away in 2014. He's like one of my favorite figures from these stories. He decided to take the job as seriously as you can take the job. Like when he's like, okay, I'm Secretary General of the Conch Republic, he keeps firmly that tongue firmly in his cheek, but also wants the Conch Republic to live and thrive and draw people and continue to go on, right? And some of the crazy stunts he did in order to maintain the Conch Republic include crashing the summit of the Americas in 1994 and demanding that the Republic be recognized, which they subsequently were, because everyone has a sense of humor apparently when it comes to these guys. He submitted a bid for the Florida Keys to host the 2000 Olympics, which, again, if you can even begin to imagine this road and the size of the Keys, you know that is wildly hilarious.
They have a high school that might have a field like that. Exactly. I don't think there's a lot of place for athletics there.
Exactly.
Swimming and rowing, you'd be fine.
You'd have that all day. Yeah. So here's a question for you. Shortly after forming the Conch Republic, Sir Peter Anderson attended a formal meeting with the Bahamian government in which he was asked by the leader of the Bahamas, how does the Republic exist without taxes? Mm. How did he respond? And you will get you'll get points or an accurate answer, whether it's accurate or just the accuracy, the spirit of his answer. How did Sir Peter Anderson reply to the question, how do you survive without taxes?
You get drunk. It'd be something about drinking. Because the key is such a drinking.
Oh, he said, we don't need money. And if we do, we throw a party.
I see. Because it's such a drinking culture down there. If you're a recovering alcoholic, don't go to Key West.
No, please.
There's still good food.
But you might write a great novel right before it all goes south.
Yeah, it's like one of my favorite things. There's a Green Parrot cafe, and if you've been there, it's a bar, and they have like these huge, big wooden panels that just open for the windows, summer or winter. And it's just great. You sit in there and you can just watch the world go by and have a drink at the bar, and it's like they have live music. It's great. It's like there's a lot of places like that, you know?
Yeah.
If you go into like the original Sloppy Joe's, because there's Captain Tony's and there's original Sloppy Joe's. It has like a tree literally growing in the middle of it. And it goes through the roof got like all these stools where famous people, like their stools, you know?
Do you know Skeeter's Last Chance Saloon?
Skeeter's, I don't know that one. Where's that?
Well, that one apparently is near the end of the Key because that was near where the checkpoint was originally set up. And the guy who ran Skeeter's Last Chance Saloon would fire this fake cannon, which never shot anything, but was loud as hell and would just make the Border Patrol fucking hit the dirt, which I thought was hilarious.
When the blockade was on, you're saying it? Yeah. And his name was,
Skeeter.
It's the last chance until you get there's a bar like literally 2 miles this way.
And if you have a beer in the car, nobody cares. This story I dug up because I think it is of particular interest to you and me and some of our mutual listeners, which is how our Conch Republic intersects with a micronation in Australia. Hmm. So there are, you know, around the world, there's a lot of these like small independent micronations. Some are recognized, some are whimsical and silly, like the Conquered Republic, and some are not. They're not all bloodless, right?
Yeah.
This one is called the Principality of Hutt River. It's also called the Hutt River Province. Yeah. It's about a 29-square-mile outback farmland on, like, the southwest coast of Australia. And it began in the 1970s when a farmer named Leonard Castley declared independence as a protest to the taxes and the wheat production quotas.
Sure, yeah.
Okay. And he styled himself as Prince Leonard. He granted his family royal titles. There is a gigantic gold bust figure of him, like, on the property. And similar to the Conquered Republic, they were sort of kidding, also didn't pay their taxes, and had a lot of tourism. People would, like, come there, and they would capitalize on the idea that, like, you bought into it, and they would sell merch and stuff like that. It ultimately, however, and this, what the connection here is, the province, while he was still alive, Leonard Castley heard about the Conquered Republic, and of course is thrilled, and it was the Principality of Hutt River that endowed Peter Anderson with the title of Sir.
I was going to ask you that. How is he a sir? Yeah.
He got it from an Australian micronation, which is hilarious. And
I thought you were going to say Tasmania for some reason.
Right. But, and they were like, what a redundant thing to do, to be like, we're on our own. Be like, yeah, we don't. Yeah, yeah. Don't make a big thing. But this is in conclusion, because I read this stuff. I was like, I thought it was adorable. That was my first reaction. The Conquered Republic, what an adorable story. And then I became somewhat passionate about it as, like, probably the answer to everything is to just, like, add way more humor and a little bit less seriousness, but never to really back down from what you want and what you feel is just. And this is the official mission. If you go to the Conquered Republic and you'd like to get your passport and become an honorary member, you can. They say their borders are a frame of mind, so we're all welcome. Their mission is the mitigation of world tension through the exercise of humor shall always be foremost and paramount in the minds and deportment of our citizens. And and in the words of Sir Peter Anderson, when he was meeting again with that leader from the Bahamas, he said, quote, "Madam, the only anti-gravity device yet invented on this planet is levity. So it is our function to be the joker of the cards. You may not always wish to play with us, madam, but we have to be there or you're not playing with a full deck."
Oh, that's killer.
Come on.
Bilge cleaner.
Oh, all hail, Sir Peter Anderson. So my last pitch to you is that you and I commit to go to the Conquered Republic Independence Day celebration at some point. If you're listening to this,
when is that?
New as rain, it's in April. The next one, if you're listening to this live or within a few days of this episode coming out, you've got about a month to plan because this is their annual independence celebration in 2024 is April 19th through the 28th. But if we can't make it this year,
I can't.
I'm going to write that in pen on my 2025 calendar and join up, sign up. I'll do whatever. I get my stale bread. I'll wear their uniform.
I'm down. I'm going to be in Australia this year for that. So I already know April 20th when I leave. But next year I will do it. There's a comedy club there.
Yeah, let's go.
There's a good comedy club.
We'll do it.
Comedy Key West or whatever. Yeah, that's where we played. It's fun. So, all right, I'm down. I mean, any trip to Key West is, you know, you don't have to twist my arm to go to Key West. So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll take a selfie. The world will know.
Yeah.
Well, that my friend Forrest, that was our journey. You and I, we went over the overseas highway.
Yeah. That was
we
great.
Crossed the ocean.
And I knew some about that story, but I didn't know he had so many details that I was like, wow, that was pretty amazing. Yeah,
it's a cool history. I'm really grateful.
The Confederate thing is like the water balloon. Like,
what I like is imagining sort of the HQ where they're like, "What are we gonna do?" And they go, "You know, Sloppy Joe's has a garbage bag full of comforters they were about to throw away. We could drop those out of a plane on them."
Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, that's good. Water
balloons.
Let's
do it.
That and then hitting the guy from the knee with the bread is like, ugh. The guy must have been like, what the fuck?
And then to be like, I declare war on the United States of America. As an officer in the Navy, you have to look around and be like, am I supposed to kill this fucking guy? Like, he just declared war and hit me with bread. And then he goes, I surrender and request $1 billion in aid. It's genius. I'm putting this in pen. I'm saving my bread. I'm going to get it nice and stale.
Well, you might want to pick it up in Miami. We'll get some. Okay. Cuban bread in LA is not.
Okay, good idea.
It's not authentico. It's like,
thanks again to my guest, Forrest Shaw. Find him on all social media at Forrest Shaw. Check out I Don't Know About That and his other podcast, The Merman. Links to all can be found in the show notes. And when he and I take our epic road trip to next year's Conch Republic Independence Festival, you'll hear about it because you already follow the podcast on Instagram. Or you'll get bonus content from when we do it because you subscribe on Patreon. Ugh, look at you. You do everything right. In the meantime, we'll see you back here for our next new episode, The Freedom Rides, with comedian Dave Reinitz. Now, this one had me on my heels. It's a chapter from the civil rights movement, the summer of 1961, when a few brave souls dared to test the established federal law mandating integration on public buses traveling through Jim Crow South. One of those brave souls was Dave's mom, Janet, who proves to be an indelible character in this incredible history. Until then, our theme song was composed and performed by Kat Perkins. She's so cool. A reminder that you can find my sources, links to the books, documentaries, and articles I reference in the summary of this episode, or by emailing us, hilfpodcast@gmail.com, or messaging us on social media, @hilfpodcast. This has been Hilf, History I'd Like to Fuck with Dawn Brody. I'm Dawn Brody, reminding you that history is a party, and everybody's coming.